Hello, everyone. Welcome to the American Blue Economy Podcast. I'm your host, Admiral Tim Gallaudet, CEO of Ocean STL Consulting, former Deputy Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, also former Assistant Secretary of Commerce, and before that, the Oceanographer of the Navy. We're a monthly offering by the American Shoreline Podcast Network and brought to you by Coastal News Today. The American Blue Economy Podcast brings together leading voices in the ocean, coastal, and Great Lakes-based economies to expand awareness and collaboration, identify positive solutions to address the many challenges to the ocean economy, such as conflicting uses and climate change, and provide thought leadership on keeping the blue economy at the forefront of American conservation and prosperity. Today is the fourth episode in a series on technology in the American Blue Economy Podcast. My most recent episodes dealt with uncrewed or unmanned systems, biotechnology, and before that, artificial intelligence in the blue economy. And today we are going to explore space, or specifically satellite technologies that are making great contributions to the American blue economy. And just for reference, I wrote about this topic in a Real Clear Science op-ed of 31 January titled Seven Technologies Revolutionizing Our Understanding of the Ocean. But before I begin, I'd like our listeners to know that our media team at Coastal News Today is looking for sponsors. And if you are interested in becoming a sponsor, please contact Tyler Buckingham at tyler@coastalnewstoday.com or go to coastalnewstoday.com/advertising. So I am delighted to introduce our guests, who are all world-class leaders in emerging space companies that are advancing our understanding of the ocean and the environment, the conservation of it, and the sustainable use of our oceans. And so first up, we have Natasha McGrady. She is the Director of Government Solutions at the commercial weather company Tomorrow.io. She is coming from Londonderry, New Hampshire. Thanks for coming on board, Natasha.
Thank you, Tim. I'm excited to be here.
Right on. And we also have Mark Lorden. He is co-founder and chief development officer of Exospace in Pasadena, California. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thanks so much, Tim, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Cool, cool. Me too. And we also have Jess Halsey, director of government services at Zona Space Systems. She is in San Diego, California. Welcome to the show, Jess.
Thanks, Tim. Excited to be here. And thanks for pulling together such a great group of colleagues. Really looking forward to it.
Right on. That's the fun thing about the show. I really bring in people, and often they make connections that last afterwards for a long time. And last but not least, we have John Fisher, president of Brandywine Photonics in Westchester, PA. Thanks for being here, John.
Yes, Tim. Looking forward to a great discussion.
Cool, cool. All right. Well, hey, let's just get underway now. And first off, I want to begin with Tomorrow.io. I've actually had Kelly Peters from the company on a show prior to it, but we mostly focused on the weather decision support services they provide and the weather intelligence. But I brought Natasha on to talk about space. But before we do that, I think it would be fun, Natasha, if you were to maybe just begin by explaining how you got here, and which I was involved with.
Of course, Tim. So my background was actually in the U.S. Navy, and I started my career at the Naval Academy class of 2010. So a shared academy graduate. Go Navy.
Go Navy.
Upon graduation, I was went to flight school, became a pilot. I flew F-18s. And then transitioned my career about midway through to become a meteorologist and oceanographer, or a METOC, which is how I first came across Tim Gallaudet when he was oceanographer of the Navy. And so I served there total time in the military for about 12 years. I was in my last command as our assistant operations officer of one of our fleet weather centers when I actually was given a brief by Tomorrow.io, and Tim Gallaudet was there, and I was very impressed with what we were doing for climate change and the platform that was happening, and was also briefed on the space program at that time, and really got the chance to hear about how groundbreaking the technology was that Tomorrow.io was doing. So I left the Navy in May of last year and started my work here at Tomorrow.io, and I'm coming up on my one-year anniversary at the company.
Wow, already. Well, that's so great, Natasha. We're lucky to have you. And to know that we have someone with a Naval Academy degree, a fighter pilot background, and now an METOC professional. Is we couldn't ask for anybody better. So thank you for that introduction. I'd like to go to Mark Lorden now. And Mark, you have a very impressive background, graduating from Caltech with a Bachelor's of Science degree. And also, you have an MBA. And tell us a little bit about your journey to Exospace, if you could. I know you've been with several companies. Just briefly as an introduction.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Tim. So I graduated from Caltech in 2016 with a degree in mechanical engineering. Caltech, they have great connections to JPL, lots of cool space projects. And naturally, I took advantage of none of that while I was there. I kind of wound my way through various industries. I worked in water processing for a while, and then moved a little closer to the space industry. I worked in manufacturing process improvement at a consulting firm that worked with Glenair. If you don't know, manufacture a lot of electronics components for aerospace systems. Right around the time that the pandemic hit, I made the leap into the startup world. It was about 2 months after Exospace was founded that I joined up. I just recently had my 3-year anniversary with the company, and it's been quite the ride building out our on-orbit computing technology.
Really cool. Yes. Natasha doing weather with her satellites. We'll get more into detail at Tomorrow IO. And you, Mark, with this on-orbit edge computing, which is really just blows me away. I love that with the idea, and I can't wait to talk about the applications. And cool. And Jess Halsey with Zona Space Systems, you've had a very interesting career. You worked in several companies. I know you were a geospatial system engineer for BAE for a decade and a half or so. Could you just give us a little summary of your journey to get to Zona Space and what Zona Space does?
Yeah, absolutely. And really loving the intro so far. Thank you for your service, Natasha, and just so great to see these connections that are happening. And, you know, that's really what it's all about when it comes to supporting the new space economy, because everything that we're doing is new and emerging. And so it's really going to require a lot of crossover. And so I'm hearing Mark and how far he's come in his journey. And I was prepared to, you know, tell a woe is me story of how new I am to what Zona is doing in the world of satellite navigation coming from the Earth observation space. But yet I can't hold a candle to what Mark has done to get over and to be supporting the space community. And I think that is just so cool. But yes, I started as a wee systems engineer supporting the NGA before it was the NGA. And so my background does come more from a space Earth observation and remote sensing perspective. But having been introduced to Zona Space Systems and learning what we're doing to disrupt the world of satellite navigation, it was a very compelling story. And I have become myself very enamored with the startup community, having spent 16 plus years with a large defense contractor. And so it really became a no-brainer. And I am also bearing down on my 1-year anniversary since joining the team.
Hey, that's a congrats. That's great to hear. Well, wonderful. And that's actually a really cool intro to our next guest, John Fisher of Brandywine Photonics, because I'd say if there's a seasoned veteran among us, excluding me, it's John, who has started out at the University of Alabama, then got his master's degree in electrical engineering at Penn State, and then worked at the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C., near and dear to my heart, but then founded his company, Brandywine Optics first, and now Photonics, going on almost 2.5 decades. So, John, I kind of repeated the intro you might give, but what other insights might you want to share of being someone, a professional in the space industry for such a long time and seeing the changes that are occurring now? Just tell us about your company and where you see us in that big picture.
Thanks, Tim. Glad to. I started out at Naval Research Labs as a lens designer, and I really loved how the being involved in ocean color and flying in the airplane, seeing, getting data, working with one of the greats, Kurt Davis, one of the leads of ocean color. But working for the government, I wanted to move faster. So I started with Brandywine. I founded it in my house. I built my first spectrometer in my spare bedroom. And then a few years later, built the HICO spectrometer, which flew on station for 5 years from 2010 to 2015. And that was when I was a three-person company. So now we're around 10 people. And it's very exciting to be still involved. We're working a lot with Air Force Research Labs on a cloud imager, an infrared sounder prototype with NOAA. And, the future is wide open. Just submitted a proposal for the Coastal Observer for the Blue Economy, which is a very low-cost hyperspectral imager for very high-resolution coastal observing and hyperspectral, 128 bands. And it's just an exciting time, what I call space 3.0, where instead of waiting 6 hours for your data, you get it in 1 or 2 seconds, and you get much lower cost, millions of dollars for a coastal observer instead of billion-dollar programs.
Right. That's just such good perspective you have. In fact, and like Jess, who had been with a big defense contractor, you who had been in government, John, I too have had a background in government overseeing and dealing with meteorology and oceanography space systems, if you will. And seeing how fast the private sector is moving has just been exciting as anything to me. And you're appreciating that. You're a part of that. And it's just great to hear. And I want to talk more about that Blue Economy proposal submission and other work. So that just thanks everybody for those terrific intros. And so let me go now to Natasha McGrady at Tomorrow.io. And let's get into a little details, because you're doing something with your company in the space sector that is just transformational. And that's why I jumped on board with the company a few years ago, because I saw that vision of doing something nobody else was doing. Will you explain what that constellation that you're building will do and why it's important?
Absolutely, Tim. And I just want to reiterate what everyone said. It's so neat to get to come together and talk about many different ways that we are revolutionizing space right now. I think we're on a cusp of an age that's just going to be transformative in so many worlds. But Tomorrow.io, we are doing, our satellite constellation is weather sensing, which Tim already talked about earlier. It's a global constellation based of radars and passive microwave sounders. So we'll have our two Pathfinder satellites, which are launching this month and into the next quarter. It's groundbreaking radar technology that we are basically going to be mimicking ground radar observations from space. We're building on proven background SDR technology that already exists, that's been in the atmosphere proven. It's actually one of the sensors that flies on the NOAA Hurricane Hunters already. And we've used that technology and are going to be transforming it up into space. Our Pathfinders radars are going to be Nadir-looking radars. They are our proof of concept for our operational radars, which will be the next phase, which is going to be a scanning radar, giving us a much wider swath. So we love to say this is GPM on steroids, because what we're doing is taking a lot of proven technology that's been done from NASA and JAXA and these large science and space agencies across the world, and we're shrinking them to make them more cost effective so that we can launch more to decrease the revisit rate. And then as we design this constellation, we actually realized that a passive microwave sounder, we did a lot of research and realized that it can be a really good partner to the active radar. So the other part of our constellation is going to be 18 microwave sounders. We're building off of Lincoln Land's TROPICS technology. So we're taking TROPICS and doing a few modifications to it to make it a little bit better revisit for our own constellation there. So between the sounders and the radar, we will be able to get revisit rates globally of less than an hour of radar images. So if you can imagine talking about the blue economy over oceans that have no radar coverage in much of the world, how instrumental this is going to be in that economy to be able to help out with those areas.
Right on. And in fact, it's amazing. You look at a map of the world where that has radar coverage, weather radar, which is life-saving capability, because most of the impacts of severe storms is with the precipitation and flooding and storm surge. It's over. You have coverage over North America for the most part with the National Weather Service's network of weather radars. You have Europe has great coverage, but the rest of the world has near nothing. And over the oceans, as you mentioned, also nothing. So the improvement in weather forecasting is going to be exponential with the data from these systems. And and weather impacts so many aspects of the blue economy: shipping, of course, port operations, tourism and recreation on the coast and the Great Lakes. It's exciting. And so thank you, Natasha. That was great introduction. We'll get down to some more on that. But let me go to Mark Lorden. Now, Mark really interested me with his company Exospace, and this idea of doing edge computing on orbit. Mark, explain to us why that's necessary, and maybe provide an example of the illegal fishing work you're doing with Thailand.
Yeah, absolutely. And first, I want to say, Natasha, congratulations on the upcoming launch, and That sounds like a really exciting application, and I think kind of has some parallels to what we're doing with our technology. So one of the primary issues with Earth observation in spacecraft is that, especially with more complex sensors, when you're talking about hyperspectral sensors where you have one image with, say, 30, 50 different spectral bands that are being imaged. So essentially, you get 50 images for one sort of area being covered. There are just massive amounts of data being generated to the point that it is impossible to image the entire Earth and downlink all of that using current communication channels. And so where our technology comes in is we plan to process that data onboard the satellite as it's being collected to, first of all, discard images that are not useful, that have cloud cover or otherwise are uninteresting to at least our customer base, and then run those images through various data processing algorithms. And this kind of connects up to the artificial intelligence applications that you featured on your show a few episodes previously in the series. And essentially having the important features in this data being collected identified within seconds of capture. And that enables notification of events such as natural disasters, illegal fishing activity, poaching, conflict tracking, just to name a few, within 60 seconds of capture of that data, which is just a massive improvement over the current state of the art, particularly on the commercial side. I know that government and particularly defense systems are a little bit further ahead than some of those commercial applications, but our aim is to really democratize this sort of technology and make these capabilities available to anybody that wants it. And one of our first customers is a nonprofit that's working in Southeast Asia and specifically focusing on coastal Thailand to track illegal fishing activity, which damages the environment due to some of the practices carried out by these illegal fishers, such as dredging, and also the local economies. Many of the coastal communities are dependent on the fishing industry to for their livelihoods. And by having large commercial fishers come in and deplete the aquaculture stocks, they're essentially losing their livelihood. So that's just one of many examples that we're going to be tackling on our first mission, which is launching in October with Sidus Space. So we're very excited about that.
That's just terrific, Mark. Right. And it was something that John alluded to in the change in this industry occurring, where the now information can be put in the hands of decision makers almost instantaneously, where in the past, the data would have to be downloaded at some ground processing system and then sent to some operational kind of command and control or center to then post-process the data, et cetera, before someone like a fisheries enforcement officer at NOAA can act on it. It's the bad actors, the fishermen, are already gone. And this is a really important area, because China is the greatest culprit on this issue, and it's depleting local economies, key partner nations in the Pacific and in Africa. So absolutely great capability, great example. And I just we'll ask you a little bit more about the details of the technology a little bit later there, Mark. But thanks for that. And now going on with all this just fascinating discussion, I wanted to get to Jess at Zona, and I would like you to tell us as much as you can about this Pulsar capability that Zona is fielding. And for our audience, the PNT is a term, positioning, navigation, and timing. I was the oceanographer and navigator of the Navy, and I was in charge of all the PNT research and development for the Navy. And I was also on the Naval Observatory, and I was in charge of the timing part of it, being the authoritative source. And I came across your company, Jess, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is something I dreamed about. I only dreamed about of having in the Navy as a backup to GPS. That's what you're providing. Explain that a little bit to us for people who don't understand the importance of what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for that awesome setup. Yeah, so we're building satellite navigation for the age of autonomy. That's really what's driving us here at Zona. And why we're doing that, I'm sure in your previous experience with the legacy system, GPS, or collectively as they're known on the international and general scale, GNSS, these global navigation satellite systems are historically government owned and operated and offered to the community with essentially a take it or leave it type of approach. Of course, as you understand in your experience with the Navy, there's flavors of that system, and there's a bit of a different use case there for the DoD with their M code and all of that. But essentially, as modern technology companies, largely driven again by autonomy, as you surfaced in your previous episode, Tim, are marching very fast to the tune of innovation, and they require the location, accuracy, timing services to be of a quality that is not able to be provided today. And so we're seeing these folks invest in correction aids and alternatives to essentially get around the fact that there is no space-based PNT alternative that's available today. And so Zona has just become the patent holder for our low Earth orbit, or LEO, PNT service, commercially known as Pulsar. And so we have founded in 2019 by a core group of experts that all originated in their connections to one another at the Stanford GPS lab, where this technology was born in the 60s and has become the preeminent status quo for academia and in nurturing this technology. And so after spending some time at companies like SpaceX and Maxar and other automotive companies, they came back together and founded Zona on this premise of low Earth orbit PNT. And you think, well, why didn't GPS just move out of their higher orbit regimes, you know, down closer to low Earth orbit? What's going on there? What was Zona able to do? And we were able to really center our innovation around that clock technology, these large, expensive clocks that are an integral part of that inherent GPS or GNSS architecture. And so our innovation comes from being able to not take a novel approach to that element that essentially has afforded us the opportunity to reduce size of our payload and do some other innovative things in the signal space that results in a signal that is 100 times as powerful as what we are able to get with GPS today, and pushes us into a centimeter level accuracy, which is really what's needed and is a gap today when we talk about truly autonomous systems.
So interesting. I could talk to you all episode on this, Jess, but thank you. Quickly for the audience, again, in terms of positioning on the Earth or above the Earth in the reference frame of the Earth system, this centimeter precision is absolutely unbelievable. I mean, when I was the superintendent of the Naval Observatory in charge of these applications for the Navy, I never dreamed we'd get that close or that precise. And we operated the clock system for the U.S. with a billionth of a second accuracy. And we did that for, you know, these high precision DoD applications with missile technology and in space vehicles. But that becoming commercially available is absolutely mind blowing, and that's what Zona is doing. Zona is spelled with an X, by the way, and again, it's not just because it's neat and good. It's that it's essential right now in this age of autonomy. As you see, that Amazon is looking to deliver via aerial drones, and everyone is really most of the population is dependent upon delivery service now for their goods. Many, I know my family during Christmas, we ought to get stock in Amazon. But anyways, it's exciting to know how that evolves, and Zona is going to be so instrumental on it. More to talk about that, Jess. Thank you. We definitely want to get some more time with John Fisher of Brandywine Photonics. I love your story going from ocean color instruments, ocean color being a very important part of the blue economy with respect to water quality, support, really important data for fisheries management and science. I want to really learn more about this new blue economy submission you wrote me about and initiated this entire episode. Can you just give us a little details about what the request or the proposal is for, and what your solution is to meet that request?
So my proposal is focused on obviously ocean color, the impact of hyperspectral imaging. And what's hyperspectral imaging is, instead of taking three or four colors, you're taking 128, 256 color bands from the visible to the near infrared. And that's good for, you know, detecting harmful algal blooms, mapping coral reefs, doing a hurricane recovery, looking at perhaps oil spills or chemicals. So a real coastal ecology perspective. And what's different? Well, NOAA is planning to launch this billion-dollar program called GeoXO. That has, you know, 100, I think it's 1 kilometer resolution, and which is not really good enough for coastal ecology. We need 30 meter resolution to really look at our inland bays and waterways. So the Coastal Observer for the Blue Economy leverages the new technologies, which is space internet. We know a SpaceX Starlink for very high data rate. It leverages low latency, have a large constellation, which can give you a half hour revisit or 1 hour revisit which is important because we have tides. And you can't do tides very well looking at, you know, once every 6 hours. And then thirdly is advances in optics. I'm very excited to be a telescope designer at this age, where a regular person can put a half meter telescope on orbit for in that $30 million range compared to a typical $1 billion program.
Right, right. That's so fascinating.
I'd just like to mention multi-domain autonomous systems. That is a big change also, where instead of a satellite being an autonomous, you know, stovepipe, where we connect those to, let's say, a sail drone or connect it to an underwater vehicle or a buoy, seeing this as a system of systems as opposed to a solo satellite.
Right. I've talked about that with autonomous vehicles being networking multi-domain surface, undersea, and aerial drones. But that's great. I love that you're including the space domain too, because that is exactly it. I really like that. I really like the applications too, John. That's just terrific to hear. And again, so was this for the NOAA GeoXO program, and was this a study you completed?
This was through the Small Business Innovator Research opportunity for NOAA. So for those listeners, the Small Business Innovator Research is a grant opportunity by Air Force, Navy, and NOAA to submit your ideas for new and innovative research, which can save both the taxpayers' money by having innovative technologies inserted at a lower cost to the taxpayer.
Right on. That's great. I love that. I love that small businesses are getting more and more into this. Previously, like you said, multi-billion-dollar platform development that largely big defense contractors and primes have led and really exclusively owned. And now you just see this wonderfully diverse mix of really agile and innovative companies coming from everywhere. So going to you, Natasha, with Tomorrow.io, you are focused in, you're based in Boston, your company, and you're in New Hampshire. You work remotely. Can you give the audience a little bit of background, kind of that culture of the company and origins with the founders? We have two founders on our show, and being John and Mark, I have great respect for founders. They have to work their tails off for very little returns initially. Just to get a little background on Tomorrow.io and commercial weather and what they were trying to do.
Absolutely. So all three of our founders have military backgrounds in the IDF. They are Israeli. We are a U.S. founded company, though. And they really, when they founded this company, they were really taking the idea of weather intelligence, which is really where our company was founded in, from an operational perspective. So as pilots, they had many experiences, as have I, of times where they really needed a more accurate weather forecast or really just a more operational forecast to be able to really do their jobs better. And so they really tackled this problem and said, you know, how can we deliver a better forecast without, with being innovative in a startup culture. And so as Tim mentioned, a previous episode, Kelly Peters was on talking about more of our SaaS platform part of our company, which was really the founding part of this, where we created our weather intelligence platform that delivers operational insights. And so that was kind of the founding part. And as we were doing discovery and the company grew and we started building out insights and really this platform to multiple verticals through the enterprise side of our business, we realized the SBIR that we talked about, technology and the government just being so far behind in that idea from enterprise and private companies, that we started branching out into the government as well. And that includes Department of Defense as well as NOAA. We've done some work with them. And that's really kind of where our satellite constellation also grew out of, was we really took a look at what is the biggest missing puzzle piece that we see to really more accurate and operational use case forecasts. And that missing radar is so huge for so many different parts of the world. As Tim mentioned, if you look at a graph of where weather radar is available, it's so concentrated to the developed nations of the world, particularly the US and Europe. There's many missing areas over the oceans, coastal regions being out of touch with it as well. And so that's when we decided to go to space to get our own sensing technology for what we were missing for our platform.
Like that. And for our audience, Natasha, thank you. SaaS refers to software as a service, and this for Tomorrow.io, it's their weather decision support tools that provide insights and for various applications. They have customers ranging from the big airlines like JetBlue to rail services and operators that are very susceptible to crosswinds, for example, of these rail lines, and you name it. It's really interesting. Going to the startup culture, I love this idea of someone looking at something and seeing a problem and figuring out a better way to solve it. And that's what you're doing, Natasha, with commercial weather. Also, data as a service is what your satellites will do, DAAS. And then Mark here doing something very similar with at Exospace, Mark Lorden. Can you tell us a little bit about your products? You have a Featherbox, Featherware, and Feather apps. What do those do? And I'd love to know where the name came from.
Yeah, absolutely. The naming process for both the products and the company were sort of a very iterative process. We kind of threw a lot of names quite literally at a whiteboard and just kind of went through process of elimination, voting between the co-founders, and we landed on Exospace, and Feather Edge was the sort of umbrella product, and then the Featherbox, Featherware, and Feather apps are sort of the constituent components. And so the Featherbox is the hardware. It consists of a radiation hardened enclosure. So we use radiation hardening or radiation blocking material, and also have an integrated thermal management system. And this enables us to use commercial off-the-shelf or COTS computing components in space. So we don't need to go through the radiation hardening process that most space-based computing technology relies on in order to operate reliably. And that puts our development goalposts years ahead of competing technologies, because we can stay on pace with the latest Earth-based computing technology, and that's developing at the cycle is 6 months to a year for the next greatest processor, and the improvements are exponential. We're currently working on our Gen 2 product, and that has a 100x improvement over Gen 1, and we expect at least that level of improvement for Gen 3.
Wow.
And so that, and we can easily upgrade the technology because we've designed our custom electronics that integrate the COTS hardware into the enclosure to be very adaptable to new processor technologies. And this also enables us to partner with companies that do produce radiation hardened computing hardware so that we can tackle deeper space missions, looking at MEO, medium Earth orbit, and GEO, geostationary Earth orbit, where the radiation environment is a little bit harsher and we might need a little more robustness in the system to protect against that.
Mark, what about Cislunar? Now that NASA is looking to go to the moon and then to Mars, is that even a harsher radiation environment?
Absolutely. Yeah, the radiation environment is somewhat comparable to medium Earth orbit. Counterintuitively, medium Earth orbit is actually a harsher radiation environment than geostationary Earth orbit. And you can expect to see a very harsh radiation environment there. in cislunar space at Mars and out in deeper space. The types of radiation that you're seeing may be different, and you may encounter some different radiation events. But that's kind of the spectrum of applications that we're targeting with partnering with radiation hardened computing technology. One of those providers is Ramon Space, and we're currently working on integrating their systems with our system to tackle some of those deeper space applications.
Interesting. Okay. And Feather, what's the difference between that and the Feather box? The box is the hardware.
Yeah, absolutely. So Featherware is what essentially enables the functionality of the system. So our system can host a broad range of data processing applications. And in order to do this, in order to be able to update those applications after launch, in order to be able to upload new applications, and in order to be able to, in general, upgrade this system while operational, we've developed what we call a middleware layer. It basically sits on top of the sort of base operating system, which we use Linux, and acts as a container for these data processing applications. You can think of them like apps on your phone, and that's kind of how we plan to sell them to our customers. You can pick an app from the store and apply it to an area of interest. And like you mentioned, Feather apps, that is those are those applications, the specific data processing applications that sit on top of or within Featherware, and that's kind of the secret sauce for our technology. That's what we've patented, and it's entirely hardware agnostic. It can run on any system that can run Linux. So not only will we be hosting this on our hardware, but we'll partner with other companies that have similar computing capabilities to implement this technology across other constellations as well.
Interesting. So let me get this right. I did for my master's thesis, and this relates a bit to what John talked about, a multi-band NOAA, the sensor was called AVHRR research project, where I looked at, I forgot, 7 bands of this optical to an infrared sensor. And I did a bunch of change detection on the California current, screening out clouds. And this is all data that I had been downloaded by, the NOAA had archived files of all this data. So I was doing it like a past research project. But you, if we had AVHRR connected to one of your Featherbox, or for example, it on orbit, I could have done that processing, done all the change detection, and had answers almost near real time. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, our target is within 60 seconds of capture. Now, if you're looking for change detection, obviously you're going to need multiple passes over the same area. But as soon as a change is present in an image from a previously collected image, you'll know within 60 seconds is our target.
Well, what's neat, Mark, is that there's research projects which look at basically deviations from the mean as an important signal. And so had I like a climatological snapshot of the California current in December, you know, I could then now in real time conduct studies, research with this kind of capability. That's important data to know the deviation at any current time, especially as we'd all talk about climate change and its impacts. So very neat. Thank you for that. I want to go now to Jess with Zona and learn a little bit more about your business model and application. So you have this positioning service, which is exquisite and very reliable. I think the power you talked about of your signal is going to be transformational in terms of its resilience to jamming and other types of interference and multipath that occurs with GNSS signals. Now I'm a user. I want your service. And how are you going to provide it to me? Let's say I'm a port operator, and I want to track things moving around my port, and knowing which ship is going into which berth and which crate's going to what container ship. Let's know about that.
Yeah, and you need to make sure that the truckers that are driving into that port with their spoofers on to make sure their employers don't know where they are
yes.
mucking up all of the things that you just described, which is actually a very real problem that happens. And so that really brings us back to that, the anti-jam, contested environment spoofing is part of that as well, and the resiliency of the signal to be able to operate in a contested environment subject to myriad of these combinations of jamming and spoofing attacks requires a certain level of security that goes with the signal. And it is, of course, transformational, the inherent resiliency that comes with the increased power of the signal as well. And so there's many factors that are working in favor of Pulsar, the PNT service, in terms of being able to sell the user, in terms of that port operator being able to more effectively operate their port. And so then to take it back to the first part of your question, which is, well, how am I going to go? How do I buy it? Is this a Sirius XM subscription? Do I need a device to accept the signal? How does this work? And we recently just posted to our newsroom an announcement with Saffron Data Systems and the upcoming availability of an Aurelia high fidelity simulator that will be capable of simulating the Pulsar constellation when it's fully populated under different set of circumstances. And, you know, that is an example of one component of our ecosystem, the simulator communities, and helping folks be able to model all of this out and understand the use cases before our constellation is fully on orbit. But we also have partnerships with receiver manufacturers. So we had an announcement. It's been a while now with Hexagon Novatel, and there are over 12 receiver manufacturers. We probably have a baker's dozen at this point that are working to integrate the Pulsar signal into their equipment right now, and that is running the gamut from, you know, the DoD types of devices that we see enter into programs of record, supported by Army, Space Force, Navy, et cetera, or even mobile, you know, mass mobile as a market. And how do we get devices such that they can be realized? And our approach there has been to allow the receiver community to accept and innovate and adopt that signal. And as the space-based signal provider, provide that signal in a way that it can be easily integrated into existing hardware so that we are not creating a new problem in terms of closing the gap on that access to the capability. And so our goal is to be as ubiquitous as GPS. And we are finding that the majority of our receiver manufacturer partners can do a firmware flash only to be able to accept the signal. And so that is going to greatly allow us to use the supply chain, use what's there already, and not set us back in hardware adoption life cycles.
Right on. Good stuff. Gosh, I love that you and your fellow panelists have all just thought through these challenges and problems deliberately. And just great job. Love to hear that. And thank you. And now I want to go to John Fisher, Brandywine Photonics again, and talk a little bit more about his company. And now you're building instruments And that's what you've been doing. And you in this whole kind of environment that is accelerating in terms of the ability to use these instruments, to move the data to people who need it. And I want to hit the one thing that you commented on, because I thought it was very insightful. And so you conducted a MetNet Sounder Set architecture study. Is that correct?
Yes, it was called a Sounder Set. We brought together multiple partners in our what we call a MetNet Alliance, which is several co-performers in Brandywine for infrared sounding and imaging, a microwave sounder partner, GNSS, reflectometry, and a radio occultation partner. And we presented this as a holistic system, which we call MetNet, based on a paper I published in 2018 at the SmallSat conference. So the idea is to have this ecosystem of small, affordable satellites that you can come together instead of the big GOXO $20 billion program.
Exactly, exactly. Yes. And I know that this is something that, let me know if you were touching this or in part of it. But when I was at NOAA in my relatively senior position as the acting administrator and deputy, I was supporting a study conducted by the NOAA Satellite Line Office, NESDIS, called NSOSA. It was something like the NOAA Satellite Observing System Architecture Study. And it was based on exactly what you just said, that we knew we could do better in terms of the architecture than owning $1 billion big systems that take years to build and are very high risk to a more diverse architecture consisting of either commercial vehicles and sensors or our own sensors on commercial vehicles and platforms, or data as a service that Tomorrow IO is going into. And now, so was your study a part of that, or is it more of a precursor?
It was a response to the NSOSA study. One thing the NSOSA study didn't take into account was Elon Musk. Dropping the cost of $50,000 per kilogram for launch down to $5,000, and with Starship launching, it could be down to a few hundred dollars. So that study didn't really take into account how the drop of launch costs would affect the marketplace. The other is CubeSats, and now I think everything's moving up to the ESPA class. A bus, a spacecraft bus, which is the platform which the payload would go onto, now is a commodity. Loft orbital, you can get on a loft orbital or side of space, and you don't have to worry about FCC approvals or mission. And it will get to the point where, Brandywine or Tomorrow.io or Muon or other Spire Global will just give a payload to someone, and they won't even know that it launched. All they will know that the data is on Amazon Web Services or Azure within 30 seconds.
Well, that's just amazing, John. It's incredible that now satellites can go aloft without us even thinking about it. Having been in the profession for as long as we've had, I graduated from my undergraduate the same year or so you did. Seeing what's occurred in the last 3.5 decades has just been absolutely remarkable. And I love it. So thank you for that. I'd like to move into our last set of questions and go to Tomorrow.io's Natasha McGrady. And I want to learn about what you're putting into space so soon. You have a launch planned when and from where, and your Pathfinders, what there's two of them. Can you just talk a little bit about that, your recent plans here?
Yeah, of course. So we are launching our first Pathfinder radar, which will be the first commercial radar in space. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, multiple space agencies have launched radars, but they're for research purposes. So we will be the first commercial operational radar in space. That will be really our new proven technology of our constellation, and will be really the footprint for us to go on and build our operational radars, which we plan to launch about 8 to 10 of them in our constellation.
Very cool. That's exciting. I can't wait to follow it. And let me move on now. I'd like to talk to Mark Lorden of Exospace. You said October you're going to launch what in orbit on what platform and where?
Yeah, that's right. So we'll be on the SpaceX, I believe it is Transporter 9. We are going to be on Sidus Space's LizzieSat 1 platform. Shout out to Carol and the team over there. That'll be delivered our first generation Feather Edge platform will be delivered to them by the end of next week for integration and final testing, and then will be delivered to SpaceX pretty shortly thereafter. And that'll sort of be our Pathfinder mission. We'll have a 40 meter optical imager on board, and we'll be servicing some of our pilot customers expanding our commercial market offerings, which is a great feature of our platform. Like I mentioned, we can bring on new customers at any point and add applications for them while we are on orbit after launch.
Right on. That's exciting. Good stuff. I'm excited to follow you too. And Jess Halsey with Zona Space Systems, when are your Pathfinders going aloft?
Yeah, great question. Well, we are following a very similar model as it sounds like to what we heard from Natasha and Mark. However, we put our first Pathfinder on orbit in May of last year. So we can share the excitement for you guys in your journey, having, you know, already and just recently experienced it ourselves. And we have, similar to what I heard Natasha describe, a twin of that Pathfinder mission. And we've actually held that twin in reserve and are in the process of considering, you know, what we're going to do with that second asset. We have had a very successful on-orbit experience with the codename Huygen Pathfinder that we put on orbit in May of last year. And of course, this is just a side note historical reference because names are fun, aren't they, Mark? Huygen and then Munin is the twin to Huygen. And they are references to Odin's ravens in mythology, I believe referring to thought and memory, and they would essentially fly around the Earth and deliver information back. So, anywho, our Munin, our second Pathfinder, is essentially in reserves, and we may apply some of our more modern signal waveforms to essentially do an update on that Pathfinder with some of our lessons learned from the first mission. This is so important to the journey, is being able to actually get on orbit and do these experiments. And that's, you know, one area where I think there's really a lot of potential for government R&D to continue doing the good work through SBIR and other programs to help foster investment in these technologies that have tremendous dual use applications. And these Pathfinder missions, I think, are the government is uniquely positioned to help support and make sure that these technologies make it over that all too real valley of death when it comes to getting them into operations, in particular when we're looking at something like what Zona is offering with an assured PNT solution that closes a very key gap for the DoD community.
Absolutely. I know that to be true. And so good. That's so great to hear. Thanks for your your words of encouragement to the other panelists, Jess, and now going to John Fisher. John, I'm interested in what, as everyone here is kind of just getting underway and lifting off, you've put things on orbit already. So maybe as a final way of inspiring the others, could you tell us what you have put on orbit and summarize those? We're all ears on hearing this.
Our primary example is the hyperspectral imager for coastal observing. That was launched in a close collaboration with Naval Research Labs. They were our prime customer. And we built the spectrometer optics and helped them integrate it into a system. We have two potential launches for next year. One is in the first quarter of 2024. Cloud imager for Air Force Research Labs. And then second quarter is a national defense project. And it's great to see that the primes are also buying into Space 2.0, faster, lower cost systems. And it's just a good example of the dual use of infrared camera technology across the spectrum.
Right. What a great way to wrap this up, John. Thank you so much. And thanks, everybody. This has just been such an awesome show. I would say maybe it was out of this world. Okay, sorry, bad joke. But thanks, everybody, in this latest episode of the American Blue Economy podcast, where we talked about space capabilities and their contributions to our ocean and coastal economy. We looked at how different satellite technologies do that, and in our next episode, I'm not sure what we're going to talk about. I'm still looking for ideas, so if anyone is interested, please send me a note. I'm at oceanstleader@gmail.com, and love to know what else we're gonna get into in the rest of the year. This is your host, Admiral Tim Gallaudet, CEO of Ocean STL Consulting. Thank you for joining us, shipmates. I look forward to getting underway with you next time.